From the mentally man, and I'll explain to you, from the mentally man is not a tradition. Never mind all the slogans and all the theories about freedom. Man is not a free being. I've never seen a slogan. At the physiological level, man is a confronted being. We can ask him, who is man? What is man? How does his humanity express itself? In what sense is he different from the animal in the field? From the bees, in the forest? I'll tell you, all creatures are not confronted beings. Man is a confronted being. He is an opposed being, he is a challenged being. He is a prisoner of the natural law and the social institutions. Man is not free because he is insecure. Disaster may strike at any moment. You can never know whether disaster will or not strike the next second. He is subject to 101 restrictive measures, some due to his being a natural creature, some are a result of his social integration. As a matter of fact, the more powerful the person is, the more restricted he is. If you ask me who has little freedom, I'll tell you the President of the United States. Although I believe there are some of them more of a prisoner than he, it is the ruler in Congress. Wherever he is, I'm measure of power. Man is a social animal, and he cares for public opinion. What would mother man do? Anything, he would sacrifice his life in order to win favor in the eyes of the public. The craze of the public call public opinion about the faith in religion. Whether the public likes him or doesn't like him. It's now almost a phobia of his people. Hence, even those who are legally free men, those who are not slaves, are in bondage to nature, to society, to a hundred of restrictive phobia, superstitions and prejudices, morals and customs. There is no free man. Only there is only one way how man can free himself from all restrictions, from all his fears, from all his phobias, from all his frights. There is only one way: by surrender to God. Surrender to God frees man from his serfdom to his fellowmen, to nature. Take for instance, in antiquity, man was afraid of one disease. That was leprosy. This scepter of leprosy haunted man in a desert. This was the incurable disease. Mother man has not won freedom from such a fright. It's not leprosy now, it's cancer. How many people are simply insane? Because of doubt in their minds, because of the fright, perhaps they'll develop malignancy. Will you call Mother May free? He's not free. Because as I said before, free is only the person who is not frightened. The frightened person cannot be free. Terror, fright, is the worst prison. Means captivity from there. How can men get rid of this fright? There's only one way. If you surrender to God. If there is faith in God, then surrender to Him. It's a great fright, of course. You have to be afraid of God too. You have to fear God. But you know very well, it's a great fright. stop these men from looking to us, from looking for us. And that's why to surrender to God does not mean to give up my freedom. I just give up my freedom for one short while, for a few seconds. It's very hard. The biological pressures, I mean, push me. And nature, the color of blood, summons action. And it happens that a particular action is being prohibited by the law, be it in the realm of dietary law, be it in the realm of sex morality, is being prohibited. All man has to do is to exert his ability to give up freedom for a few seconds, and the next hour will find freedom at a high level, exalted and enhanced, and he will be more of a free man than he was before. Then by Yitzhayu, at the Shem in Israel, if we had been taken out of Egypt, without an king, without accepting his call, without surrendering his authority, without reaching the covenant with him, without obligating ourselves to surrender freedom in order to gain a higher form of freedom, then we would be in bondage again. Bondage to whom? To nature, to our own fears, to our own phobias, to society, to slogans. Not only because the Redeemer was not just a man, but an king. That's why we celebrate Pesach. And personal is a personal authority. Now let's, tomorrow, Biyot Chazoko Ubizreya Nitula, with a strong hand and outstretched arm. Of course, you know very well the Jewish ethics, Jewish morality is based upon one foundation. What's the foundation? Volach Torah. To imitate, I mean, it's very difficult term to be used, but for the sake, for the lack of another term, we call it imitate, run. It uses often the expression being dumb in favor. We have to imitate his ways, his actions. Since in the touch of day is the very foundation of our ethics. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu used Yot HaZokho, who's Reya Betuyo, we are also supposed to use it from time to time. When in times of crisis, or in times of distress, or whenever the call comes through to stand up and to defend a certain position. What does it mean, Yot HaZokho? What do the terms Yot HaZokho and Reya Betuyo mean as far as Jewish morality is concerned, as far as human beings are concerned? What are we supposed to do, and how are we supposed to execute our plans if we are called upon to intervene in this type of situation and react? Of course, Yot HaZokho, please listen. Yot HaZokho and Reya Netuyo mean two things. Effectiveness, effective action. You see Yot HaZokho? Who's Reya Netuyo? What does it mean when you see Reya Netuyo? What is Reya Netuyo? The Cheref Neu Yodei. How the Chief of the Yodei Netuyo Al Yerushalayim? What does it mean? It means vigilance, watchfulness, alertness, being ready, being prepared. And actually, what comes to expression is the idea that man is a responsible being. Responsibility is a part of his divine endowment. Yet, and that Yahadis has taught us time and again, his responsibility is not limited to his own actions. Oh, he's therefore responsible for his own actions. To his own individual behavior, man is charged with historical responsibility. If you want, you can use the phrase of Kol Yisrael Ha'edim or whatever. If you, man was called upon, as I said before, to shape history, to be historically involved, to direct historical unfolding to our worthwhile objectives. We know know in the Halacha there are two groups of mitzvahs, mitzvahs of people, mitzvahs of yochid. Men's activism initiative within the historical drama is the foundation of Yadus. The yochid, the individual, was called upon from time to time to participate in the emergence and development of the Knesset Israel. In order to participate in the historical drama, one must possess two capabilities. First, to be always ready for action. Second, when action is called for, to act successfully. Zreya Nefunda with an outstretched arm, symbolizes the state of vigilance and watchfulness. Vigilance, actually, can be broken down into two component parts. First of all, total involvement. Who is vigilant? Who is vigilant? Who is watchful? Watchful is the mother when our baby is sick. But a stranger is not the watchful. In order to be watchful, to be vigilant, one must be completely dedicated, totally dedicated. Partial commitment does not result in steady concern and in steady worry. But these are the two cornerstones of vigilance. The state of mind which motivates men to be watchful, alert, and keen. Where we have a case in Tanakh of someone being vigilant, watchful. This is the ideal. This is the Tanakh. If the Bible only portrays such a person, it means he personified, vigilant at his best. Who is it? Who was it? Who? Mordechai, sure. Mordechai was alert, on the guard, as soon as Esther was taken away from him to the royal palace. Do you know why? Why was Mordechai? What's his answer? Why was Mordechai so alert? Because he loved her. He was devoted to her, and he was unreservedly committed to her, the proper Mordechai and all of us. A wise father or mother is at the same time a vigilant father or mother. But children sometimes, they don't worry about their father or their mother, but they're not always vigilant. Standing in guard against danger is only the person who is committed, totally, unconditionally. You cannot be alert, you cannot alert an individual to danger unless he is concerned, And basically what we need now, the Jewish community, the Orthodox community in general, the Jewish community in general, with the idea of this world, of course, but for the Orthodox community in particular, vis-à-vis the preservation of Yahweh, preservation of heaven throughout the United States, is vigilance. But vigilance is a function of total concern. Whoever is not, who is not concerned totally is not vigilant. And whoever is not vigilant will always miss the opportunity. He will come in a bit late. You will not act at the opportune moment. It's number one. Number two, it is not enough to be vigilant, means not only to be concerned or something else. It's not enough to be attentive. One must possess historical intuition, sensitivity to events, a sense of discrimination between peripheral and central occurrences. Some people can discriminate. To them, a marginal event is very important, and a central event they don't see. They need sometimes at least a spark of the clairvoyance of the prophet in order to know when to intervene and when to wait. Again, I have to refer to more. Mordechai was not only concerned, and that was the reason for his being vigilant and attentive and alert, Mordechai had that sensitivity to his faith. He felt the heartbeat, the rhythm, as he was talking drama. And he knew what the next matter. Mordechai possessed the prescience and the foresight indispensable for crucial decisions. Esther thought, for instance, what was the controversy between him and Esther? What was the controversy? The messages were flying back and forth between Esther and Mordechai, by Asok, who Asok was, I don't know. Mr. Risa, another from the unit for the king, apparently, whoever person to Esther and prosecuting the mission after freeing Mordechai. Yes. What was the controversy between Mordechai and Esther? They disagreed on to such an extent that Mordechai sent her the family warning. You must be sacrificed by his days. You need there by his days to God from out. What was the crux of the controversy? Esther thought that her intervention should be delayed. For simple reason, she explained her opinion. She explained her opinion. She said very well. She has not been summoned to appear before the king. There is a law in the statute books of Persia and Moral that whoever appears in a courtyard and in without receiving invitation of the kingdom should be executed. I mean, so she will appear before the king, she might be executed. And she didn't care so much for her life. But then, what will the poor Mordechai do? What will the Jews do? There will be no one to intervene, but to intercede on behalf of the people who are condemned to death. So she advised Mordechai that it would be rather advisable. After all, I mean, the edict of extermination was just issued. The extermination was arranged for almost a year. The edicts were issued before Pesach. And the extermination of the Jews was supposed to take place when? On the 13th, right? On the 13th of Adar. So there are almost 11 months. So she said, she advised him, and wisely advised him. Why is that now? Why violate it with the, so to say, to the Jews? Because there's a question of whether she will succeed to sin. She might be killed if the portal approaches. So let us do an election for another month. Then, over such a period of time, she'll certainly receive invitations, and then she'll come in, she'll be secure, so she'll intervene. And Mordechai, apparently, without explaining why he's opposed, sometimes in the message, the warning, and Mordechai insisted that instant action without delay, be taken. And of course, he was right. That he was right, that's the proof that she succeeded in her mission. Mordechai had a sensitivity. Sometimes he was sensitive to events. And he knows that the rest of the act now cannot explain this to me. Why? Many times, and I want you to understand. It's easy to explain to rational minds secondary, marginal decisions. Yes. Why did you buy this car? Why did you buy this car from a car? I don't know the reasons. Right. So you can rationalize. But if one will ask you, why do you love this certain person? Why are you committed to certain ideals? Why do you sacrifice your life for certain values? You cannot rationalize, you cannot explain. Central decision, crucial decision, decision to resist, which decides the destiny of this being. And sometimes the destiny of the people, the destiny of the community, can never be explained. I feel like doing it, offering intuitive something, certain light bulbs are for me, and I feel it, and I see the roads along which I have to travel. I cannot explain, I have no compass. I'll just go up and down. But I'm sure that I'll get to the objective, to my destination. I'm sure. can quote to account rationally, I cannot. This is basically it. And the passage in Shirashira says, Shuri Shuri Ashulamish, Shuri Shuri the Nechasebach. So the member says, Emrim Le'eloho, Umisayimom, the Knesset Israel, the Gentile peoples address themselves to the community of Israel, the Knesset Israel, Shuri Shuri Ashulamish, come back to us. Why such dedication? Why such commitment? Why so many sacrifices? Why so much torture and misery and agony? For that, left me in exile with this attitude, who the bridges into his transcendental heading, abode. Why? The Nazi form. And we approach you, Duxin, princess, and war. So what is one is, whom I need you? Even he was in that Israel, in all the victories, it's more convenient and more comfortable to be a boy. Why did you? Why? Shuri Shuri Ashulamis. Drop your madness, your mad walls. Your anonymous dedication. Your unlimited commitment. Or what? So what does she answer? Matachazub Ashulamis can say that some of them are in. What can I tell you? I'm just involved in the dance between two camels. I cannot free myself from the dance. You know why be a Jew? Because one cannot be a non-Jew. He has to be a Jew. There's no answer to that. It's an eternal commitment. It's a commitment which is a part of my identity. It's a part of my own existence. Can I explain my own existence? Who I am? Why I want to live? Why I am afraid of death, my relationship to my children, my relationship to my parents. Can I explain my basic experiences? I cannot explain. That's why I cannot explain the experience of being a Jew. It's a basic experience. It is the central experience. A central experience cannot be rationalized, nor can it be explained and expounded in words. You ask me, why did Mordechai tell Esther? Why did he ignore his help? There are logical arguments. He felt like doing that. He didn't explain it. But he felt now is the time. A week from now, a month from now, this is it. This is the historical sensitivity. Not technical Vashal Angus can feel us. It's an eternal dance on which no one can sleep. Yes, to dance and continue dancing until by the end of the year the Shem of God, which will happen. This is vigilance, and sale, and historical sensitivity. And of course, the man feels to intervene, he must do it effectively. Half measures which do not produce results should not be undertaken at all. That was the way the Jews already got it. They knew how, and then they were to start. When they did it, they acted effectively. Now I will conclude the evil, I feel the love of suffering, the love of the vain, the love of sin, the love of Yedin Satero, Mitro in the Messiah of the Tiyas Mitraim, the Kolamad of the Messiah of the Tiyas Mitraim, Arizem Meshubach. But I think the Lord is coming, the Lord is revealing, the Lord is doing, we have said it so many times, is subject to two interpretations. One interpretation will use the subjunctive, the other interpretation will use the indicative, the grammatical indicative. One interpretation will say, will interpret, or rather translate, that he will Kolonu Chachamim. Even if we were, if all of us were wise, even if all of us, if everybody were the subjunctive, I mean intelligent, Kolonu Skenis, even if every anyone, beware, a scholar, and so forth, it would be duty bound to tell the story of his life. This objection. But actually, human text, of course, human text is very hard to know. I mean, because it is subjunctive many times in the field. He uses some vocabulary. But it's quite tempting to interpret as you know, colonus acronym, colonus venus, colonus venus in the indicative. Even though we are not if we were. Even though we are acronym, we are venus, we are the genius, we are bound, duty bound, to tell the story of the tribe. Which interpretation do you like to choose on here? You can exercise an option. Which one would you like to prefer? The subjunctive or the indicative? What do you say? I can't hear you. The right one?
Yes,
the right one. The right one is indicative. The right one is that we are not speaking about something doubtful, hypothetical, but we are speaking about something real. As a matter of fact, of course, if it is subjunctive, so you don't understand why is it necessary to say. It's just subjunctive, we were, and actually indeed we are not, so why is it necessary to say that we are bound to tell the story of the tribe? If we mean it in a genuine sense, that we are, even though we are scholars, we are wise, we are learned, we are familiar with the laws, nevertheless, we are bound to tell the story of the tribe, then it makes sense. But only question is, if it's used in the indicative form, does it smack a bit of pride, vain glory? How can a Jew say of himself, of him, Kulana Chachorin, Kulana Nevenin, Kulana Skin, Kulana Yerim, Tatera? Then it's a lie. That's exactly what I want just to comment on that. If the second chapter in the form is that of the indicative, not of subjunctive. As I said before, I believe that the indicative form is applicable as well as the subjunctive. Sifilitias Nefraia is identical with Limud, as I said before. This study, this discourse, this medrash. We do not read the sections in Exodus. The best proof is that we do not read the sections in Exodus. During the Yitzias Mitzrayim, but we interpret the section in Dvarim, Ramei Dvarim, pertaining to few events that occur in Mitzrayim, and so it means we just study the meaning of certain words, but we don't tell a complete tale. The tale is far from being complete when we present it in Dvarim. If we wanted to tell a complete tale covering all angles, there was only one way. We start with the Venezuelan prayer by the final, read through Vaera and Bay, and finish Bay, and if we want to tell the story of Christianity, so we have to read half of the Shema until I'm near the Shemre Sehra. But we don't do that. What we mention about this is the final, which are just the highlights. And we are interested not so much in the event as in the interpretation of the words of Arami Yedoni. As the Rambam called it, the Mishnah says, Videre Shapar Shatuma, and the Rambam called it Medrash. Simply we learn, we investigate, we explore, we study. It signifies exploration, investigation, analysis, etc. And as I have explained many times, I don't know whether I did it here or not, but in real carefully, basically Cypriotius Mithraim cannot be separated from Talmud Eretz. Cypriotius Mithraim, as far as the gist of the mitzvah is concerned, is inseparably linked up with Talmud Eretz. It's simply to study Torah, either Halachot or the story of Cypriotius Mithraim on the night, on the 15th night in Israel. It's basically the mitzvah Talmud Eretz. Since the Torah has prepared hashiras, has prepared chile to the depression of the four sons, yes, including the doll and the insanity one. It is obvious that what did the Torah want? What is obvious? The Torah has prepared cancer, chile, to be given to the four sons, beginning with the scholarly son, the wicked son, the dull son, and the insensitive, they don't inquire at all. And I explained it in Maria last night, it's four different truths in the terms. However, there is a common denominator in all of them. What is the common denominator? Talk living terms. To tell the theater trial is to teach yourself. Teaching about the tribe, teaching about the laws of the paper, but to tell the Tabak of the Vinco means the Limadic of the Vinco. With the Baitish of Bain, or his Melam Bain. His Talmud here. It is obvious that everyone, no matter how ignorant, no matter how alienated, has a share in the family. Every Jew is endowed with a potential, basically, every Jew is endowed with a potential upstairs to understand, to comprehend, and to digest. I said it once. You know the Gemara about Rabbi Simoi, who said that the embryo while in the womb of the mother is taught by an angel, taught Taylor by an angel, and then when he's about to depart, so the Malach slaps him on his face, and he forgets it there. So the question is obvious to him. All Kachna Drusha. Why teach and then slap him on his face? He should forget. The Mama says, either or. If you don't want him to know, don't teach him. If you taught him, why should he forget? The answer is, why he should forget? It is a very serious question. Why he should forget? The answer is simple. Torah cannot be acquired through his gift, through work, through dedication, through study. There is not a gift to which is just granted. It's not a ready-made suit. And if one just walks into the storm, it's transferred. Without it, there is no sense. So the question is, all right, if without it, there is no acquisition of Torah, so why teaching? In order that the Talmud Torah maker should just be reminiscing. Remember. You know, Plato said that all learning is just to remember. But we are saying Torah learning is to remember. Why is Torah learning is not something new? The Jew, it's not something strange to the Jew. Something new. When you approach a child, you begin to teach him nowadays, give him down, don't raise his brother, give him his right. It isn't something new to him. He knew it once upon a time. You begin to remind him. You know, sometimes we forget an event. And sometimes, and we are reminded by someone. And little by little, we are beginning to reproduce. Paranormal is reproduction by the memory. Why should it be reproduction by the memory and not comprehension? For a simple reason. Because it's not alien. Since I knew it once, it's not alien to me anymore. I have the potential. Of course, it's latent in me. But I can reproduce it. So it means every Jew can be a great scholar. Every Jew can be a chacham. Every Jew can attain the bino. Every Jew can attain that. The potential of Torah is present in the Jew. And even when I failed to take advantage, to realize the gift that God bestowed upon him, everyone is entitled to a share in the Torah, to the intuitive perceptibility of Torah verities. And values. Everyone is able to comprehend a Torah thought if explained and expounded by a good teacher. And everyone knows, more or less, to implement Torah laws, no matter how often he has to consult the Rebbe or Rabbi. Torah is not the possession of a few. Torah is the possession of the entire Knesset Yisrael, the entire congregation. If there has ever been a democratic philosophy of chinuch, of education. If there has ever been an exoteric philosophy of education, it is our philosophy of education. think education in Greece was esoteric. To the Plato Academy, they did not admit everybody. They just admitted a few. During the Middle Ages, education and knowledge was controlled, you know, by order, by the monastic order. I mean, in England, I mean, knowledge university, the oldest university, Oxford, Cambridge, were controlled by a few and were accessible just to the aristocracy. In fact, I mean, now people begin to realize that everybody has this entitled to education. It's a question of helping those who cannot attain it by themselves. Our system of education was democratic from its very beginnings. It's democratic, exoteric. Whoever wants to study, whoever wants admission, I mean, was let in, was provided with the opportunity, given the opportunity to study. Why? Why did we develop such a democratic approach to healing, to the dissemination of Torah knowledge, to providing everybody with the opportunity of studying and acquiring knowledge? Why? Because the Torah is not something which is outside of the Jew, but which resides in the Jew. Sometimes he's conscious of it, sometimes he's unconscious. But in the deep recesses of his personality, there is the knowledge of Torah, there is the intuition of Torah, and there is the sensitivity to Torah. And Pesach night, and that is symbolized by the Seder. Pesach night, which is the restaging and the reenacting of the drama of Exodus, at which every Jew beheld Gimish Fine. Pesach night, something happened which we are unaware of. Not only the Jews left Mitzrayim, but Pesach night, the Jews were confronted by the Shine, who the male of God was the Gimish Fine. We are accustomed to say that Gimish Fine was a public spectacle as a direct seat. They came in a way, correct. But the way they are going to come, right? The same drama was staged and faced up now in the male body of the Jewish finish. That means everyone suddenly, for 1 minute or 1 hour, because that was our own, was wise and clever and intelligent and sensitive and filled with presence of God. But otherwise, it would be no excess. And I told you, when he came, when he came, in the male body. And for 1 hour or two, he was initiated into the greatest of all mysteries, and was considered a Chochom Novi Balbeir. The mission was granted that night to all of us to address ourselves as Chachomim in the reigning space. Of the post, the post, Chobir Rabir Chai, what a little start making the earth in the trial. And those Jews who left the trial, they are confronted with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So is each Jew, so is each Jew, and every, at the same time, confronted with Gimish Fine. And he has arrived, no matter how ill he is, to call himself, Chochom Novi Zokin Balbeir.